Hello and welcome. It's good to see a good crowd for this technical committee presentation on solutions for digital preservation for audio archives of small and medium sizes. Whatever that means, you know who you are. Before we start, I'd like to make an announcement that the technical committee will be meeting tomorrow at 5:30 in the lobby. We're gonna go eat probably to a nearby restaurant. So if you're in the technical committee, please join us tomorrow at 5:30 in the lobby. And if you are not here and you're part of the technical committee, well, you should be. Now, just spread the word around, and looking forward to it. We're very excited about this panel, looking forward to it. In the second edition of YASA's DC04 was published in 2009, and it included a new chapter on solutions for small and medium-sized archives. And there was a good reason for that chapter to be included. Small and medium archives had, for a long time, felt that proper digital preservation was out of the reach, both in the technical and financial aspects of it. And as a result, small archives for a long time had been doing things that were really sort of unsustainable. And perhaps they did either panic, sorry about the pop, did things, again, that were unsustainable. The most classic of which is probably burning optical discs, CDRs, and putting them on shelves, which is patently unsustainable in the long run. And it's a dangerous practice. And in fact, that has almost been supplanted in recent years by something that it's perhaps even worse, which is hard drives on a shelf. And that's maybe not supplanted, but we're seeing more and more of that. So we feel that that need remains, that that chapter that was covered in YASA DC04 remains. And the purpose of this panel is twofold. One, to give an overview of what that chapter did or said, and also to see what new tools and are available for small and medium archives since its publication, which was 4 years ago in 2009. There are two things that that chapter mentions and I think are important to realize to overall conclusions. One is that technology has advanced enough for small archives to be able to do a proper preservation of audio. And the other one is that you're gonna need two things. One is at least some technical expertise. And two, you're gonna need continued funding. And that's particularly important and has to be stressed. And I would actually add a third one, is that you'll probably have to play nice with other people. You'll have to collaborate. That's the nature of the beast for digital preservation. I sometimes like to compare it to, I don't own a car, I own a bike. When something goes wrong with my bicycle, I can usually fix it. I'm not super technically oriented, but I can fix my bike, and it's free, and it gets me places. But once you buy a car, you're in a different league. You can imagine a car with a very small tank. That's sort of what digital preservation is about. You need to buy gas, so you need to spend money all the time. You need to buy insurance. Of course, the initial cost is high. And you need experts around you. And when you get gas, that gas comes from faraway countries where there's wars and all kinds of things. So you're at a totally different level. You cannot just figure things out yourself. And we're gonna hear about this. So we're very excited to have this panel that is composed of Chris Lasinek and John Spencer and Chuck Haddix, and Angela Elam is gonna join us shortly, we hope. So Chris is gonna speak about repository software that's available. What's been happening in the last few years is exciting and sometimes confusing. And up till now, the field was dominated by probably Fedora in this space, but there's been new solutions. And let me grab Chris's bio, and I'll be right back. Chris Lasinek is the founder and president of Audiovisual Preservation Solutions, a New York-based consulting firm that helps organizations overcome the challenges faced in the preservation and access of moving image and sound content. Clients of AVPS include the Library of Congress, Witness, Stanford University, Harvard University, Yale University, and the Museum of Modern Arts, among many, many others. Please welcome Chris Lasinek.
Thank you. Thank you, Marcos. And I'm sitting here wondering why I suddenly feel guilty for owning a car.
It's evil.
I did. I will be talking about kind of going from, you know, kind of bicycle mode to car mode. Hopefully, I won't cause any wars over it, though. So I am going to be talking a bit about identification of tools, but what I really am not going to do is just give you a list and sit down and hope that you go back and you'll click, you'll download, you'll mess around with it for a second, and then put it away because it's either doesn't make sense or you're not sure how to integrate and stuff. So I want to give you a list of tools, and I want to put some context around that, and more importantly, I want to talk about how we should be thinking about how to more effectively use tools in a more meaningful way within organizations that are small and medium in size, or not necessarily size, but we can think about resources, right? So that's an important takeaway. So when we start having this conversation, we soon hit on, well, what's the difference between large archives and small archives, and these break down between commercial and open source software tools, and you know, more or less, large archives tend to use commercial and open source less, and small archives tend to rely a lot more on open source and less on commercial. And resources and workflow are kind of at the key, or at the core of this. It's a key part of the conversation, and it's something that we'll be talking about and hitting on a lot today. So open source, right? That's often where we go to when we think about use of tools and the tools that we end up downloading and using more. But it's really central to the conversation. However, there's a lot of misperceptions about open source as well. And that's that, you know, free, while many of the applications that we'll be talking about today, in fact, are free, it is not, when we talk about open source, it's not really the free that we think of, right? It's not free as in price. Open source is about free as in freedom to use, develop, contribute, collaborate. So Richard Stallman puts this well, and this sums it up nicely. And the thing that we often hear is it's not free as in beer, but free as in speech, right? That's how it's often talked about. It is both, actually. So every tool I'll be talking about today is free in price, as in you can download it for free. Not all the tools are open source, most of them are. But another misconception around open source is that because it's free to download, that it's free to use. So I would argue with maybe Marcos a little bit in his interpretation of a bike being free and say there's actually investment in that, right? That maybe it's easy to say, all right, it's not gas, but there's other investment maybe in time, although in New York City, he's getting around faster than me in my car, that's for sure. But a lot of use of tools maybe falls short in this expectation where we download something, we think it should be free to use. We find actually it takes resources. It takes expertise, you know, some human resources. It takes some financial resources if you really want to integrate it in an effective way. So it's definitely something to have at the forefront. And maybe we do ourselves injustice in filling out budgets, you know, by putting a zero on a line item for open source tools, when in fact we should be budgeting for, you know, resources to help us implement them. So how do we think about this in the context of digital preservation? Well, a good place to start is the OAIS model, right? So this points out some key kind of functional things that an archive should do. And this is not just digital preservation. OAIS actually refers to both physical and digital collections or file-based collections. But today we're talking about digital preservation. So when we look at this, we start to realize that this is pretty complex stuff, right? This is not, when we think about a small organization that doesn't have an IT person, or maybe has one IT person and they spend a lot of time doing desktop support, or several IT people that spend all their time doing desktop support, it really starts to beg the question, how do smart archives meet these requirements? So we want to talk a little bit about that, and I'm going to give some examples of how we fit into the OAIS model, and I'm going to point to some specific tools. You can if you want, but I would encourage you, the point here is not to write down these names of these tools as fast as you can. We'll distribute a list of these tools and more as a part of this talk. But this is really an exercise in looking, and you know, it's food for thought. So stay with me here and don't worry so much about scribbling down the names of things. So let's start at the beginning with the SIP, or the Submission Information Package. This is the thing that we would give to an archive. So a tool we might use here is Bagger. This is a GUI, graphical user interface, right? Something that has an interface on it that sits on top of a tool out of the Library of Congress called Bagit. And what Bagit does is it has a standardized way in which it packages information. It creates a manifest of what's in a package. It creates checksums for those things. So it's a tool that's actually been used in a lot of different applications by lots of different types of organizations for exactly this purpose, creating something like a submission information package. And it's meant for the exchange of information, which takes us to the next part of ingest. So on ingest, we'd actually use Bagger or Bagit as well, because we'd want to get that and we'd want to validate that package, right? We want to run Bagit and say, make sure that this is a valid bag. And it's going to look at the manifest. Are all the files here? Yes, they're all here. Do all the checksums match? Yes, all the checksums match. And it is a valid bag. This is a very simple tool to use. George, quit talking during my talk. I'm going to revert. This is reverse heckling because you talk to everybody. All right. So another tool we like, Media Info. It tells us identification. What's coming in the door? What type of thing do we have? How are we going to manage it? What do we want to do with it, right? Because we're going to have different actions around whether it's a WAV file or an MP3 file or any number of files that might come in the door. So this helps us identify not just the file format, the .wav or the .mp3, but it gives us a lot of information about what's inside of that file. What are the really deep technical aspects that we need to be concerned about? Another tool you might use is BWF MetaEdit, which comes out of the federal agencies. We developed it. We continue to develop it. Actually, it was just 1.3 was released last week that addresses a lot of bugs. But this tool you might use it for file validation. It does file validation for WAV files better than Jove does, so you might use it for that. You could use it for parsing embedded metadata. You could use it for running rule sets. You can create rule sets around metadata and say, give me flags if it does or doesn't match this rule set. So there's a number of things that you could do with that. Marcos, can you tell me when I have 5 minutes left? Thanks. Another tool you might use is Jove, which I just mentioned, Jove 2 in particular. It's the most recent release, and it does a lot of file validation and identification one of the sole purposes it's envisioned for is on ingest. ClamX AV, I guess is how you pronounce that. I'm not actually sure. ClamZav, ClamAV. ClamX AV is a user interface that sits on top of ClamAV, which is an open source release of a virus detection software, right? We have digital things coming in the door. We're going to put them on our NAS or whatever, you know, storage we have that we're calling our archive or our repository. Really smart to check and see if it might have a virus or not before we do that. So on the way in, we'd like to use this. This happens to be, that tool happens to be for Mac. I don't know if one exists on the Windows domain, but I imagine it may. So another function, archival storage, right? So one key aspect of archival storage would be fixity or data integrity, right? We all, everybody's heard about checksums. These are things that you want to create and you want to check them on an ongoing basis. We want to check them when we would actually check them at ingest too. And on an ongoing basis, we want to check these. Does the checksum match? Has anything been altered? Does it make sense? So here we look at MD5 for the Mac or Karen's Hasher for Windows, or we're working on a tool, Fixity, that does an automated version of just ongoing scheduled checksum verifications, all in the open domain. But there's an example where I don't believe MD5 may be open source, I can't remember. Karen's Hasher definitely is not, but it's a free tool that you can use. Data management. So Collective Access is an application that's picked up a lot in adoption over the past couple of years. People really like it for collection management, and it's used by a lot of different organizations, and it's an open source application. Here's a key example of something that's not free in the sense. This takes an infrastructure and a level of sophistication for integration, and it really still relies very heavily on the developer who developed the system to do it. And it requires a lot of configuration and stuff. So this is not, you know, not something you're gonna download, double click on, and be running on in a couple of days. This is a larger effort. But the payoff is big too, you know. So on the access side, we might look at something like SOX and SOX wrap. So you'll start to see I have a lot of these slashes, right? So SOX wrap is the graphical user interface of SOX. It's something that you can use. SOX is a audio transcoding tool that you could use to create access copies. VLC, I think, if not the most, one of the most widely downloaded open source tools on SourceForge and probably in the world, does tons of things with both video and audio, one of which is, you know, creating access copies and clips of things and stuff like that. So kind of the input is the SIP, the output is the DIP, the distribution information package. And in thinking about the DIP, you know, we've got a content to express and to distribute. So we might look at like an open source web CMS like Drupal, content management system like Drupal, or we might look at what I would call an open system, archive.org, which is used by many people for exactly that purpose. On the administration side, you know, this could be any number of things. An example here, though, might be use of like Drambora, a tool out of the UK, that is a self-auditing tool for looking at your repository, right? So this is a really good tool for looking at what the strengths and weaknesses are of your repository. It's got a very well thought out, you know, kind of walkthrough questionnaire, and very helpful in doing some administration of your archive or repository environment. So there's a few strategies to think about when thinking about using tools, and we're going to go over them. The first strategy is to just simply use tools as is, right? So this is, I go Media Info, I download it from SourceForge or Media Info site or whatever, and I start using it, just like that. Now that is typically very low investment. It's also pretty minimum reward usually, and it usually requires very manual labor, right? So this is because these are very single purpose tools. So with Media Info, for instance, I can do one file at a time. I have to do everything. I have to read the output and then figure out what to do with that. So it's very labor intensive. And large organizations don't do this. This is something, you know, when we looked, whether you're using commercial or open source, it doesn't matter. Automation is key to building efficiencies and making things work more effectively. George, I'm gonna send you to the office in a minute, buddy. Go see the principal. All right, strategy two is kind of the next step up. So that would be adapting tools to meet your needs. So this is some amount of customization where we're actually taking a tool. We might have hire somebody or have someone internally that can start to automate things for us. And that usually involves some level of being able to do scripting or coding, you know, different levels of kind of sophistication and expertise to start stringing these tools together. Now, and this is where we start to kind of cross over where I was talking earlier, and a lot of the examples I gave are this term I used, GUI, right? Graphical User Interface. When we start looking at these kind of stringing together of these very single purpose, or, you know, they do one or two or three things tools, we start looking at needing to string those together. We start moving towards what's known as the command line interface, where we would not be doing this manually, like I said, but we want to start saying, all right, we're going to run an MD5, and then we want to check that MD5, or we're going to run media info, and if we get this result, then send it over here, and if we get this result, then send it over here. So this is a key difference. So let's think about some of the things, like what are some of the things that we want to automate in our day-to-day workflow? And this is actually a conversation that would be great to have. It's something we'll hit on in a little bit. But for now, I'm going to run through a couple of use cases. So one would be just simply, like this is an example I gave, we could take media info, right? And we want to output it. But we don't want to do that for one file. We have thousands of files, and we want to do it for all of them, and we want to put them into a CSV, which is, you can think of as being able to open in a spreadsheet application, so that we can look at how many of what types of files do we have, what are their technical details, not, you know, how many waves do we have that are stereo versus mono, 44.1 versus 48, 24 versus 16, how many MP3s do we have that have images embedded in them, or, you know, anything you can kind of think of. We want to be able to look at a profile of our collection so we can do some planning around it. So typically you might start off with a directory structure that's got tons of stuff like this. A script would run. This is the command line interface for media info. We would point it to those directories and we'd say scan everything that's in there, put it into a CSV, which this is an insane spreadsheet to think about actually reading. Not very fun, but then we can push it into something like a Google Docs or OpenOffice spreadsheet application or Excel, and we can start to build reports that are a lot easier to look at and a lot more insightful than looking at just pure raw data, right? And here we're just looking at codecs. This is a report of what types of codecs we're running into within this collection. But we could report on anything that's in there we could build a report around. Another use case. So let's say we want to create access copies, right? We have our preservation master files. We want to create access copies. We want to package them all together. We want to generate checksums, transfer them to storage, and then once they're stored, we want to verify checksums. That's a lot of manual labor. That's a lot of time, a lot of double checking, high opportunity for errors to take place because it's manual labor. This involves waiting around for machines a lot to do things and then getting distracted with Facebook and doing all kinds of other stuff, right? So isn't it great to think about automating that? So we might use SOX, right? The application that I talked about that does the audio transcoding, string that together with Bagot, send it to Bagot. Bagot creates packages and generates the checksums. We use an application, rsync, which is all about transferring files, synchronizing between storage devices. We send that to a NAS or wherever we're sending it, to the cloud or whatever, and then we would run Bagot again. So that's something that we could automate using these open source tools. So what prevents small archives from doing this? Seems pretty easy, according to this presentation. Well, I think we all know the reality is it takes resources, right? Because we have to hire people. It's hard to find people, developers, coders, people who can do this are in high demand. Every day there's something in the New York Times about data scientists and the tech boom, and geez, these people are really expensive and hard to find. So how can we start to overcome this? Well, one is defining requirements. If we can't articulate what our needs are, and this is a big reason why a lot of projects in general, but use of applications and tools fail, because often people will just go to, oh, this organization used that tool, it must work for us too, without really thinking about what do we actually need to do, what are we trying to accomplish, What are the things that we need to get done? So unless we can articulate our requirements and issues and needs, we can't come up with effective solutions. Education, and this is kind of multi, like one is archivists really should be thinking about, or I won't say archivists, because I actually like thinking outside the boundaries of archives and just thinking about people who are caring for collections, really need to be learning about things like coding, not to be coders, not to be people who can write scripts, but to be able to engage in conversations. The flip side of this is we need to be doing education about what our needs are. We need to be raising awareness. We need to be out there making some noise. Partnerships, huge. We're going to, this part of this talk. There needs to be partnerships with organizations that do have more resources that we can leverage, where there's a mutual benefit to smaller organizations and larger or more well-resourced organizations collaborating on something. And of course, pooling resources, because once we can define not only our requirements and articulate them, but rather all of our requirements as a community and articulate them, we can put our resources together and come up with common solutions for common needs. So some examples of this that are inspiring, we look at the Open Planets Foundation. This is an example where they have, this is the wiki, and this is exactly that. Communities across organizations, cross-disciplinary, looking at articulating needs to then people who can provide solutions, coders. There's a lot of people that are interested in helping out communities in need. There's a lot of programmers that are out there that are interested in helping out organizations, archives, people that, activist organizations, all kinds of things, right? So, but we have to be able to tell them what we need. There's been a lot of work that's been people doing stuff, building tools that don't actually represent our needs. But this is an example where this is happening very well. So this is an interesting place to look. And Paul Wheatley brings home the point that we actually have a role to play, right? Because there are, like I just said, there's lots of talented people out there who want to help and are willing to help, but they need to hear from us, the people in this room and the people at EMEA and the people at the various organizations where the real expertise is. So often I think we sit back in a bit of a quandary and we think, we don't, this isn't really for us. It's not like, it's a different thing altogether, building applications and stuff. When in fact, they very much need, to hear from this group. So another great example is Curate Camp AV Prez. So this is just a bunch of thumbnails from the video. This is on archive.org. There's 6 hours of it. This is a something that was headed up by Kara Van Malsen, who works with me at AV Preservation Solutions, Lauren Sorensen at BayVac out in California, and Steven Villarreal at UVA. Came up with this, put it together, coordinated it. These strips you see right here, this is Google Hangout, and those are all people. They had multiple Google Hangouts, people coming in and out based on who was collaborating, who was going to give a presentation, who was discussion. Curate Camp is very loosely organized, right? They had over 150 people. There were people in New Zealand up at 4 a.m. to participate. There were people in the UK at midnight participating. It was a full 6 hour day of just, when they put it together, I'm just going to be honest, that's not going to go over well, right? You're not going to be able to, the technology is going to fail. It's hard to maintain people's, it's hard to be collaborative online across countries with the technology and stuff. It was a huge success. In fact, people from larger communities, from the Presto Center in EMEA looked at it, and this is actually done under the auspices of EMEA, but looked at it and said, geez, we would love to do that. This is a really effective thing, and there's a wiki where they came out of this day with lots of really great information, not just presenting, but actually collaborating, identifying what the issues were and where there are solutions and where there's not solutions. 5 minutes, all right. So what are some other tools we need? Well, these are just examples. It would be great to be able to navigate audiovisual content in a more meaningful way. For that, we need time-based metadata, right? All kinds of it. File validation, while we look at Jove 2, for audiovisual content, pretty horrific still. Automated obsolescence monitoring. This is one of those things that everybody's talked about for years. We need to know when files in our collections, of which there are could be hundreds of thousands or millions of files, are close to obsolescence. And that's not something we have. It's still a manual process, or you have these global format registries and stuff that it's done by committee. That's not ever going to work. And then there's other, these are tools that we're working on, right? So Fixity, like I mentioned, automated QC, inventorying I'll be talking about tomorrow, and this issue of interstitial errors. So these are some tools that are close to my heart. Sometimes the solution isn't met by existing tools. We might look around, we have these conversations, we collaborate, and we realize there really isn't anything out there to do that. So that leads us to strategy three, developing new solutions, which is, of course, the highest investment and usually, hopefully, the highest reward. And again, how do we do this? And this is where I say, remember what I just told you a minute ago, right? It's these things. We have to define requirements. We need education, partnerships, and pulling resources is key. We need to be thinking on that level and get out of our own organization as an island and start thinking about the larger environment and not just other archives, but other disciplines. And it involves openness. Openness is a key aspect to this. And Stefan El-Nabli sums it up well when he basically says, look, these solutions really are for the community and to be driven by the community. This is very much about that. There needs to be engagement. So I'll leave you with kind of some of these questions that I think we should be asking ourselves as individuals. We need to be asking ourselves within our own organizations. We need to be asking this within ARSC and across disciplines. These are the types of things we need to be thinking about, because this really is, I truly believe that this is the only way we're going to bridge the gap from being able to just kind of hobble along to actually making things work. And there's some success along these lines already that provide kind of a beacon of light there. So I'm very optimistic that we can do this, but I think it does require a little bit of different thinking. So with that, I'll turn it over to the next presenter and would love to talk more about it during the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for calling me on the bike is free thing too, because it's true. The bike may have plastics, which also come from, it's not as simple as it seems, but hopefully the analogy works in general. I also wanted to mention, I think Chris alluded to it, but we're hoping to put up a resource page on the ARSC website that will have some of these links. So I encourage you, like Chris did, to grasp the concept and not be writing down URLs. And also emphasize what Chris mentioned, that there's sometimes almost an insidious aspect to free software, in the sense that it's almost as if I give you the car for free and then I'm the only one with the gas that makes it run. So there's some maybe suspicious practices in that in that openness of certain software. Okay. Our next presenter is John Spencer, and he will talk about storage solutions beyond what's mentioned in TC04, which basically talks about hard drives on RAID systems plus an LTO backup without a hierarchical storage management system. A lot of storage solutions have been coming up, and I'm excited to hear about it. John Spencer is the president and co-founder of BMS Chase, an archival data management and migration service. John has been involved in many facets of professional audio and video since 1978 and was acknowledged as a digital preservation pioneer by the Library of Congress. His early work on structured metadata collection for audio led to the publication of a comprehensive report, first published in 2003, titled Recommendation for Delivery of Recorded Music Projects. The report was written by the Delivery Specifications Committee of the Producers and Engineers Wing of the Recording Academy, of which John is a member. John is also the chairman of the Studio Metadata Working Group for DDEX and works as committees for AES, EMEA, and RPB, and the National Digital Stewardship Alliance for the Library of Congress. Please welcome John Spencer.
Thank work.
I didn't know it. You gave it to
me. Yeah, you gave it to me. It looked easier. Does that work? Cool. All right. I like this easier. Okay, I've just got to click on one button here, and I think I'll be good to go.
Yeah, and then F5.
Bang, and F5, man. Yeah. Okay. I was tasked in this particular panel with addressing pretty much a snapshot of kind of the latest storage trends. A couple of caveats. I hate following Chris because he always seems to have the most coolest, slickest presentation of anybody. And he has hair, too. So I don't think you're gonna, you know, beyond being follically challenged, you're certainly not going to be, shall we say, overwhelmed with mine. It has more of a film noir, black and white look. I think back in, the second one is, I think back, I don't know, 2002, 2003, somehow within the ARS community, I was tattooed with the letters LTO tape on my forehead, and but you know, doggone it, it actually has maintained its relevance, and it certainly can be a part of anyone's, particularly small and mid-sized archives, strategy in terms of how they approach and address their storage needs. So with that, no further ado, I'll just move on. You know, I think that one of the things that small and mid-size archives, and I would even include major record labels in that, is that we really may not all take a look at the backside, kind of, you know, okay, we applied a methodology when we put our storage archival process in place. Okay, do we need to revisit that? As you said, 2009, and IT technology, that's about 200 dog years. So, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, we're blowing past things, storage capacities, costs are trending down, distribution costs are trending down. So, you know, it's really something that, quite frankly, published standard documents these days really can't stay on top of. So it is incumbent upon those of us that are engaged in that process to make sure that we're understanding, you know, what's going on today, not what was going on in 2009. That won't matter. So the first thing that I will take to task real quickly here is optical media. As you can see, it's trending down. And again, just like Chris said, don't bother writing down any of these URLs or anything like this. We'll make sure it's all put on the site. But you can see the significant dip there just from 2010 to 2012 in terms of recordable CD media. I think we've long reached that point where we kind of have gotten over the argument of the shelf life of the carrier, because if you have not reached step one of that process, you know, acknowledge it, because it's true, and it's not getting any better. You know, again, while it may continue to be a short-term solution in terms of, you know, perhaps a part of your geographical separation, access, etc., trend's not your friend. There is a new optical media, and again, I don't want to single these folks out, I'm sure they're a wonderful company, that has actually been approved by the Department of Defense because it says these discs are going to be readable for 1,000 years. This is my personal opinion. Not acknowledged nor endorsed by my company, per my lawyer's request. I kind of have significant concerns about this kind of stuff. I mean, the bottom line is, where's the hardware, where's the software, where's the firmware that is going to support that 1,000-year playback? So I think if we all don't kind of look at the overall overarching part of this, and if we can remove ourselves from thinking that the shelf life of the carrier is really related to the viability of my archive, probably going to be doing all of ourselves a little bit of a favor. And as I said, think for a minute. I mean, can anybody think of, a company that is, other than countries, that have lasted 1,000 years? I win. So, I want to touch on a couple of new options that are certainly current and buzzwords and non-buzzwords, but I think important things. You're going to see a couple of points in here where I said more on that from Chris, and really when I say more on that from Chris, because I think part of what Chris was trying to convey and did so is that it is not just the fact of, from creating digital preservation files to putting them to the cloud or this or that. There is this entire middle layer that exists with respect to the things he spoke of with respect to fixity, integrity, and those types of things that are very important that we must make sure that if we are going to take a particular route, say the cloud, for example, that we have to incorporate that into our negotiations in the way that we put together our service level agreements, et cetera. So I'm going to briefly touch on the cloud some and also talk about LTFS because, again, when I'm tattooed with LTO, I might as well go ahead and bring you up to speed on what the latest is with that. And then the managed cloud services as well. The cloud. Okay, so it's like what my 10-year-old daughter now is on iCloud. Who isn't on some sort of personal cloud? Google Docs, Google Drive, etc. The upside is cheap. If you've looked at the pricing at Amazon Glacier, and I am aware personally of about at least 5 more companies coming to market with price points that will be lower than Glacier that are all coming to market. It requires little IT engagement or experience, with the caveat being that you know what you've done in terms of making sure that you put your service level agreement in place. Cons. Lack of reporting. Again, something Chris touched on earlier. Cost of downloading. If you do decide to change service providers, that is something that has kicked many folks kind of in the backside when they least expected it, was the cost of pulling down 5 terabytes, 10 terabytes, 100 terabytes of data or less. Just what the all of the costs involved were in terms of pulling that down. And I get back to the SLAs, or the service level agreements. Did you do a good job negotiating yours? If you didn't, seek outside help counsel, beyond the ARSC listserv, there are a myriad of places that one can go out and seek help. I'm one of those kind of people. You want to send me an email, I'll be happy to reply back. But that is part and parcel of the negotiation in terms of making sure what you know your costs are if you do need to make a change. Does the service provider understand the needs of your specific organization? In most cases, I would say they do not. And will they still be in business? And if not, have you established the backup plan for your archive? this, while we like to think of, wow, this is the savior of the industry now, we can just park everything up in the cloud and forget about it and pay our monthly fee. And you know, how many have already gone belly up? I mean, I could have provided a slide with a bunch. So, you know, again, in your planning for these types of new storage mindsets, you know, you gotta be thinking proactively about the worst case scenario. And then, of course, depending upon the institution, the library, et cetera, the local access copy issue still needs to be addressed, which may very well be addressed by CDRs, having trashed them two slides ago. The other one I brought up was LTFS. That is a linear tape file system. And starting with, first, just a quick show of hands, familiarity with LTO, yes or no? Boy, has that changed. My tattoo worked. You know, the thing that drove me to that was that we were realizing that our company, for example, we deal with, you know, several hundred terabytes of data on an annual basis. We don't keep it, but it passes through our system. So we have to follow the trends of what Fortune 500 companies do with their data and what their IT department does. You know, particularly public companies, you know, they are tasked now with the implications of Sarbanes-Oxley and HIPAA requirements regarding your health records, et cetera. Sarbanes-Oxley, many people refer to as the Enron law, try and maintain a level of liability for corporate executives when they can just say, oh, I didn't know that was going on. So the accountability factor is really ramped up. And so that's why I think it's very important that we pay attention to what those people do, because there are significant penalties that will come into play if they make a mistake. And so we can learn from that. So LTFS, starting back with LTO5, it essentially, what it is, and I didn't provide a slide with an example, but really, it's a directory tree. I mean, everybody has opened up a hard drive and they see the directory tree and all the various files and folders and applications and things underneath them. So I think we're all familiar with that. Prior to LTFS, essentially, if you were going to use an LTO tape, you needed to most likely write what is called a tar archive. And that meant essentially you're taking a batch of data, dumping it to the LTO tape, and if you need to make one change on that tape, you have to restore the entire data tape to make that one change. Doesn't make a lot of sense. Secondarily, it's also important for people to have a much smaller, you know, as in terms of a 30 kilobyte PDF, for example, on their desktop that shows the directory of what is in that LTO tape. Let's say you have your archive is 800 gigabytes, a terabyte. You know, you could easily park that on an LTO5 or an LTO6 tape. And if you do it using LTFS, then you now essentially have a complete snapshot of all the contents, and you are also able to pull that back individual files, as opposed to having to, you know, pull back the entire archive, which is a very important thing in terms of workflow and time saving. So, LTO, I mean, I must say, the storage density and the input output write speeds are continuing to increase, where we are now seeing LTO6 libraries actually being utilized in video post-production, which is something that most people would never associate with a data tape. But quite frankly, the I/O write speeds are, they're up there, you know. I mean, so that is one thing that certainly has been advantageous for post-production companies, because of the low cost of the media, but more importantly, it's also really speeded up the workflow for those people that need to get things in and out. And it's also changed the mindset. When you do have to go in and make a minor change, it's not like an 8-hour day shot. As again, you heard me talk about the Fortune 500 companies, and there is wide acceptance for LTO and LTFS in the IT community. Cost per terabyte continues to remain very low, and the cost of drives, LTO tape drives, continues to drop as well. That's one of the things that at every panel I come to that people talk about. Oh, well, you know, like if it's a recording panel, you know, it's like they have no hesitation at spending $3,000 on the latest mic preamp. But when it comes to like spending $2,000 on an LTO drive to back up all their creative works, they seem to be confused by that process. Before I came up here, I just took a quick look, and it was like, I found brand new LTO1 drives out there for like $199. I'm not advocating that you buy LTO1, but I'm just telling you that when you hear that high cost barrier to entry stuff, you know, do some work on your own. I don't buy into that, and I don't think you should either. But, you know, there is a cost. So, I mean, certainly you need to be aware of it. And the related hardware, you know, the SAS cards you got to drop into your computer. Then you will need, essentially, even if you're doing it via spreadsheet, Excel spreadsheet, you're going to need to have a place where you can park those directories in front of those users that need to have access and see what is actually in your archive. The integration of LTFS directories can also be accomplished if you have built your own, you know, rolled your own, so to speak, in-house database, FileMaker, whatever. You know, you can bring those things in as PDF, attached PDFs, etc. And it does require a baseline of IT experience to implement. It's not like you've got to bring in a full-time, you know, 120K guy a year to do this. It's not rocket science. Moving on to the managed cloud services. I'm only hitting on a few here because otherwise I'd spend the entire hour and 45 minutes just naming everybody who is now, we're in the cloud business. But what you're beginning to see is a trend of what people call managed cloud services, because the idea of a managed cloud service is that you remove a lot of the cons that I spoke of earlier in cloud storage, and that don't worry about it, we'll take care of it for you. Some of them, such as DuraCloud, for example, will replicate your data across multiple hosting providers. I believe in DuraClouds, it would be Amazon, Windows, and I believe Rackspace, if I'm not mistaken. But then there's OVH and a number of others. And then there are folks like PermaVault that can help you in replicating data updates across your own internal, you know, local area network. So there are a number of things of companies that are providing services out there to, shall we say, you know, bring the knowledge base down a bit in terms of what you have to know or what you don't have to know in terms of being able to use the cloud as part of your geographically separated optimal archival backup methodology. So, as I said, you know, I mean, they can help and they can remove some concerns. They can give you more in terms of reporting, bit level fixity, which is something that if you're not aware of that, it's just essentially ensuring that on a regular basis that we know we do have an exact bit for bit copy up there. Downside is, you know, yeah, it's another cost layer. And I'll go back to this point again. I mean, do they understand you? Do they understand what you do? Do they understand that perhaps you are not going to be a high intensive input-output type of client, but maybe only occasionally needing to access the digital preservation files while having your own access copies locally, so that you really are using them as a storage system? Or are you just another, you know, invoice number or customer number? And that's not what you want to look for. And again, I think this community is tight enough to understand that you reach out to three or four people, you're going to get a few answers, but you're going to get some good answers, because there are a lot of people out here in this audience and in other audiences that do have a lot of experience with respect to this, and essentially know they've walked the walk and now they can talk the talk. And so I believe that is the end of my show. I didn't even put up a self-grandiosing shot, a logo of my company or anything, but I look forward to the question and answer session later on. So thanks for your time.
Thank you, John. Okay. Okay. We are excited also to have Chuck and Angela here talk about collaborations. Collaboration, in perhaps in its simplest definition for an archive, means distribution of tasks, right? Instead of everyone doing one thing, you distribute the tasks. And that can take many, many, many different forms. They can be particularly valuable to small archives, and we could probably argue that they're actually inevitable in small archives because of some of the things that we've mentioned earlier. Interestingly, TCO4, for example, considers a vendor a collaborator, which of course it can be. We're not going to focus on that from that perspective. But interestingly also, I find that TCO4 gives maddeningly little guidance on how to work those collaborations, the pitfalls, the advantages. And hopefully John has covered some of that, I think, and we'll cover a few more in the next few minutes. Because there's so many different types of collaborations and partnerships and consortia that are possible, we decided instead to focus on a local partnership here at UMKC. And for that reason, we invited Chuck Haddix and Angela Elam. And I'm going to read their bios. Chuck Haddix is the director of the MAR Sound Archives at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and host of KCUR-FM's Fish Fry, which is one of my favorite things, fish fries, a very popular radio program featuring the best in blues, soul, rhythm and blues, jump and jive, and Zydeco. He's also our host, so be nice to him. Over the years, Chuck has contributed to a wide variety of theatrical, recording, video, and film projects, including Cronkite Remembers, a biography of Walter Cronkite, Robert Altman's Kansas City, and Merchant Ivory's Mr. and Mrs. Bridge. His articles have appeared in Downbeat and Living Blues magazines. In 2005, he co-authored Kansas City Jazz, From Ragtime to Bebop, A History. And in 2012, Chuck received a Pinnacle Award from the Johnson County Library Foundation for Excellence in the Arts. Chuck just finished Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker, which will be published by University of Illinois. Is that right, Chuck? University of Illinois Press, and teaches Kansas City jazz history at the Kansas City Art Institute. Okay. Angela Elam is the producer and host of UMKC's literary radio show, New Letters on the Air. Angela has worked in public radio since 1988, but she got her start as a reader for Radio Deutsche Welle in Cologne. I probably did a horrible job with that, but in 1981, pardon my German. She received a Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Georgia in dramatic writing, and immediately upon graduation was seduced into public radio at WUGA-FM in Athens, Georgia, where she produced literary programs and later served as host and technical producer of the local magazine show Centerlines, which received a Public Radio News Director's Award. Angela has also produced radio dramas and special features, including freelance stories for National Public Radio. Most recent recognition has come from the 2010 New York Festival International Radio Awards for Arts Programming and a 2011 Clarion Award for the New Letters on the Air program, when she named Fire. Please welcome Chuck Haddix and Angela Elam.
I think we're going to go have to share this little mic here. I don't want to go off. But you might ask what the heck we are doing up here. And in addition to my duties of collection development, why don't you bring us up a couple of mics? Why don't you mic us? In addition, can everybody hear me okay? Okay, good. In addition to being the director of the Morris Sound Archives, I oversee two preservation labs. And we've been involved in preservation since 1992. We've preserved the recorded legacy of St. Olaf. We've done a lot of work for the Chicago Jazz Archive, preserving the John Steiner oral history collections. And so these kinds of collaborations are not new to the Sound Archive. Great, thank you very much. We've had a long relationship with New Letters on the Air. In 1996, we wrote a grant proposal to the NEH to preserve the New Letters tapes and to transfer them to store them at the Morris Sound Archive. And it's kind of funny because I was reviewing that grant, and the grant proposes to preserve them to open reel tape and make two cassette service copies. My, how things have changed over the years. And the nice thing about our collaboration was that we're both affiliated with the university. We're both within units within the university. New Letters is a literary magazine that has been on the air for over 30 years. Allen Ginsberg, Rita Dove, all the Pulitzer Prize winners are represented for the last, 35 years? Mm-hmm. And so these tapes have been, I've lusted after these tapes for a long time. It's the major literary collection, and it exists on open reel, DATs, and cassettes. And in 2010, Angela and New Letters was awarded an American Treasures grant from the National Park Service.
Save America's Treasures. Okay. It's no longer, it got axed with budget cuts. Okay, it got axed with budget cuts, but it was Save America's Treasures grant. And I think the last one was given the year after we got ours. So
Angela asked us to go ahead and put a bid in on it and for the preservation. So we went ahead and wrote it up and submitted it. And she was awarded the grant, and then they subsequently paid us to transfer it. It was a good deal for them because we charged them half what we would most of our clients. And George Blood was brought in as a consultant on the project, and George showed up at our door and put us through our paces, and we passed muster. So we went ahead and did the project over a 2-year period of time?
By the end of it, by the time we got the funding, we're actually just now wrapping it up with our final report, which is due the 28th of this month. But the grant actually, we had to get some extensions because what happened was a lot more of the tapes had problems than we realized. It was a larger share. Scott is our engineer who did most of the transferring. He's sitting right here in the second row. And what'd you say yesterday? About 80% of the tapes ended up having to be baked. And I mean, it was a much more, it was a longer process than we imagined.
Yeah, the provenance of the tapes is kind of interesting because it's a literary program that was produced by public radio station KCUR-FM and produced in the studios. I've worked
in 1977.
Yes, 1977. I worked for KCUR now for 29 years. We've never had a good engineer there. The tapes were never, the machines were never maintained, the azimuth was never set, the tapes were not, the machines were not maintained properly, they run off speed sometimes. They're old Ampex machines is what they were. And they were recorded on that. And so the tapes themselves were problematic, and there's also generations of tapes. You had the source tape, the interview tape, and then in the early days what they would do is take the interview, cut it up, splice it, and produce the program that way. And then we had the generation, we had cassette dubs of the programs and the programs themselves. And these were all recorded on Scotch and Ampex tapes, so you know what that's like, you know. So it was a challenge transferring the tapes. The issue of intellectual property rights, though, was not a problem because of the paperwork that the authors filled out when we did the program. So we didn't have to worry about that. And what we had to do was overcome the kind of silos that we find ourselves in institutionally. The Mars Sound Archives is just about, I don't know, that 5-minute walk from New Letters. But, you know, we exist in different worlds. So we had to work together to overcome that. And go ahead, Angela. I don't mean to be dominating.
Oh, that's okay. I'm trying to think what else you might need to know about the basis of this. Because the radio show had been produced since 1977, and like he said, there were all different kinds of practices going on for a while there. It was co-produced with the radio station, and then it became independent. So from the radio station, but still at the university. But it's a nationally distributed show. It goes up on NPR's Content Depot, and then stations pull it down around the country. And it's still living and breathing. I mean, that's part of the reason I was late today. It's our production day, and so we ran into a little bit of a glitch. And so it's like he likes to, it's still organic. I mean, it's still, we're still trying to figure out, okay, now we've got the preservation done on this. What are we doing about the shows that we're producing today, and how do we fit that in with what they're doing? Part of our grant for us was to create a new website where these shows will now be accessible. And that, too, turned out to be a much harder. We're on our third web designer right now, and we're about to launch. We're supposed to be launching next week. I've got cards here for anyone who's interested. You can get one after this and find out about it. But to be able, up until this time, people could only hear the last two shows, and then they would rotate off our website because we didn't have a way to maintain those audio archives. So now they have copies of the digital archives, and I'll let you talk about the deep storage. But we also, Scott made two CDs, one that lives with them, audio CDs, one that lives with us. And then we have two separate digital files, one that's just a clean dub, a digital dub made of the original file, and then the reels. Sometimes the reels were in such bad shape we had to go to the cassettes to make a dub. So anyway, that was problematic. But then because of the cassette noise, you know how you have that noise of the tape, Scott did some cleanup where he could on things. So we have the original just straight dub, nothing done to it, and then a dub with some cleanup to make it where we can use it again. And during this whole process, and you stop me when I'm talking too much, during this whole process, every month we've been creating a new radio show that's part of our weekly series that we call the Save America's Treasures Archives. And so we've gone back, for instance, Etheridge Knight was on during Black History Month. He's been dead for a couple of decades now. And as a result, NPR just contacted us recently. They want to use part of our tape in a special that they're doing on poetry in prisons. And so it's really wonderful because it's starting to open up some things for us, I think.
Yeah, the bottom line of any kind of preservation project, of course, is to provide access to the material and to preserve it. And we provide access to the material through finding aids in the sound archives so that people can actually look up and see what's in the collection. And then she's going to make it all available online. For a long time, you would contact them and they would send you a cassette. Now the preservation, the long-term storage of preservation, we already had a program in place, and this is what we do at the Sound Archive. We, of course, are the University of Missouri, Kansas City, so the University of Missouri at Columbia is the digital repository for all of our product within the university. And they have massive server farms set up on site. It's in the library systems office. And they approached us and said, give us your gigabytes. And we said, damn straight, here they are. And so that's where we store all of our digital images. And we don't treat our audio wave files any different than the TIFF files for the photos, really. That's where that's where we store all of our audio and our digital files as wave files. And we transfer the files overnight using FTP protocol. And they monitor the files and refresh them and keep them alive, and they also back them up off-site. But as far as administrative privileges, Scott can access those files, even though they're in deep storage, if he need be. We don't normally need to, because we've got them on removable hard drives and CDs. But in case he does, he does have access to those items. And so that solved our problem of storage. One of the big things we faced right up front, and Kelly Martin, who's sitting in the back, straightened us out on this, it's the file structure and the naming. We had to agree upon that, because you can't just throw them up there, you've got to be able to retrieve them too. In fact, we had to go in and do a bunch of renaming at one point. And that was one of the great challenges that we did. And Angela, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think we figured it out what we had to rename them before we actually started on the digitizing. Isn't that right, Scott? Yeah. So we spent a lot of time trying to make it where it would be something that would last over the years. You know, in the beginning, when we were making radio shows, it would be like they would number them by the date. So all of our catalog numbers are, for instance, 05, 16, you know, whatever the year was for that particular year. And then so then we had to rearrange it to where we start with the year. And at one point it was switched over where it was 10 instead of 2010. And we were like, no, that's not going to work either, because eventually it'll catch up with us. So we came up with the NL for new letters, 2013, 05. Is it 16th today? I'm confused on what day it is. The 16th. And then that way we could keep it consistent so that when we would search for it, it would be. So once we...
Yeah, and then the of course the tapes...
And then the name at the end.
Then patrons can access it through the website and look up by the author. Or we have, like I said, we created a finding aid of all of the tapes in the collection. And this is the first phase. The second phase is to do the raw interviews, and there's a number of those. And also, lately we've been talking about our ongoing relationship because they're continuing to produce tapes now, produce programs. Now, of course, the programs today, they're digital born. And that's the real challenge, to keep those alive in perpetuity. I'm an old style guy. If I want to keep an email, I print it out and put it in a file. And, you know, like I said, I'm coming at this from an administrative standpoint. I'm not an engineer. I do run the radio station when I'm there, but I'm not an engineer. I don't have to, because I have Scott, and I can hand it to him and have him take it over. So now we're talking about our ongoing relationship and adding to the collection and making sure it's safe. But the main thing is the open reel tapes that had been stored in houses, in buildings, in studios, are now stored under archival conditions in the Sound Archives robot, which you guys will see tonight. Wait till you see the robot. You haven't seen nothing yet. And so the tapes are preserved. The digital copies are preserved at MU and kept alive there. And then Angela has copies. We have copies. And it turned out to be a real fortuitous relationship between the two divisions of UMKC. And this is the kind of partnership, I think, for radio collections that they could benefit from. At KCUR, I was talking with Marcos earlier, they don't have a preservation program. I have 2,000 hours of fish-fry programming on MP3s. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's no regular program to collect and preserve the output of these radio stations. And so much history has already been lost for the price of a tape, and the same way with a file, a careless handling of files. What else, Angela?
I'm trying to think what else you might need to know about it. I mean, I still feel like we haven't yet figured out the ongoing part of it, you know, and then the way that things are, that we'll have to address this again. I mean, things aren't going to stay static. I mean, the kinds of files will probably have to be changed. When I think about, well, just in the time that I've been producing new letters on the air, which it's been 17 years, I can't believe it's been that long, but we've gone from reel-to-reel production to working. We worked with something called Sadie, which had its own file type, and then we were with Pro Tools, which in the beginning we were using Sound Designer file types, and then we had to move over to WaveType. I mean, it's as bad as, you know, having to manage all these different kinds of tape that you're dealing with, so trying to keep up with that stuff sort of boggles the mind, especially when you're just, you've got your nose to the grindstone trying
to. Well, thank goodness you get to mini discs.
We had DAT tape for a while.
I think we can open it up to the floor now. Unless
you have actually, any questions. I had some questions for you, because I think this double trend of grant-based preservation programs and digital preservation, I think they're almost, it's a scary trend put together, because what tends to happen in a grant is you do it in 2 or 3 years, whatever, grant ends, and there's no provision for the continued survival of those tapes. And I wanted to hear your, and I think this happens very, very often, mm-hmm. In a lot of projects. So I wanted to hear your take on how you plan on going beyond the Save America's Treasures grant.
Well, I think just on a weekly basis, we go ahead and she deposits the programs with us, and we go ahead and burn a CD of them for our patrons, and then just send the WAVE file into with the rest of the collection, just to add to it. You know, there's closed collections and there's open collections, you know. A lot of times people will give me stuff over a period of years, and that's an open collection. Or you may want to add stuff later, like the KMBC collection that we have. We're always getting people approaching us saying they have some stuff. But there's some collections that are closed. In this case, this is an open collection, so.
Which is more and more required, more and more frequently a requirement of grants,
right,
that
right.
They make it, and that's a whole other topic that we could talk about. But I also wanted to hear a little bit of how the metadata traveled. I remember when we met yesterday, you talked about a spreadsheet, you talked about a website, then we're sending these files to the servers for the university, and how those things are related, and how that metadata may have traveled among all those various iterations.
Well, you know, the CubeTech Quadriga, Scott's going to have to answer that one. I'm going to defer to a higher power on the metadata. We could have done a better job on the metadata, but, you know, it's a lot like the open reel, moving from open reel to digital, you know, there's certain unintended things. Because now, if there's a dropout, we've got to go back and check to see if it's on our copy and in the copy in deep storage too. Scott, want to talk about the metadata? Stand up and talk. Go ahead.
We didn't use the metadata from the QTech system. We just didn't know what could bring it out and what we could use it for.
Here, George.
Yeah.
Scott is a man of few words. He's an engineer. Need I say any more? He's a man of few words. But he was kind enough to come in case he had to bail me out.
We didn't really make use of the metadata that you can put in the chunk and inside the broadcast WAV file because we didn't know what we were going. We couldn't envision what we were going to do with it. And at that time, we really didn't know about tools to get at it. So most of the metadata comes from Angela, from their side, the descriptions and that sort of thing.
As we're loading, one of the things that we have to do is we have to load the files individually onto our new website. So we're in the process of doing that. And we're putting metadata in those files as we're loading it up there. And we've got this fancy... It's not working still, but I mean, I know it's going to work. I have trust that it's going to work, where we'll be able to load the file. It will make, from the WAV file, it will create an MP2 file, which is what we have to use for NPR. And then it'll also create an MP3 file that we'll be able to stream on the website, and it will have the metadata. So you can imagine, we're talking hours of plugging this in, and it's interesting, the person who started working with me, George, you'll remember, George was our consultant in the beginning, which he mentioned, but Dennis was working with us. Well, Dennis left, and then Annie was there, and she's gone, and then Jess was there, and she's gone, and now we have Jamie. So, I mean, it's been a process, but fortunately, that's one of the things you have to address, that you know that everybody on board knows what you're doing, so that if somebody leaves the team, you still have people who are knowledgeable about how this is going to commence.
Yeah, and that was my next point of having an exit strategy for all of these partnerships and collaborations is essential.
It is essential.
Because many times it's one person or two driving the project, and when they leave, which inevitably they will,
yes,
you need to have something written down.
We're fortunate in that all the people who worked on this project are still here in town. The first two inherited money and left to travel. Can you believe that? I said,
yeah,
finally.
Open.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's not.
And you may inherit something afterwards.
But they're all in town. So at times when we've gotten a little bit stuck on things, you know, they're more than willing to step in and say, oh, yeah, well, this is what happened there. So we've been lucky in that way. Not everybody, I realize, is going to have that, you know, that advantage. But I feel like we're nattering on. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah, let's open up the floor for all panelists, actually.
I'd like to stay on this topic and ask about any other digital files that were created in the project. So did you digitize scripts, writing on the tape boxes? Were there anything other than audio files that were created and archived?
No, it's just the audio files. We retained all the tape boxes and had good information on it because they were broadcast tapes. And we didn't scan any of those because the information is in the database. We used it, when we created the finding aid, we used the boxes plus listening to them. But we didn't digitize the anything else besides the audio. And we actually didn't digitize everything. We picked the best copy and digitized that rather than getting to digitizing three copies.
But the metadata lives in the database. It was entered manually.
Yeah, yeah.
In your finding aid database, okay.
Sure.
Do you think that it might be...
Okay.
I was just going to add, do you think in retrospect that perhaps it might have been a good idea to scan those tape boxes and relate those to the database?
We could have. You know, we could have, but we have the tape boxes. If I need to get the tape boxes, I just go over the robot and call them up. The tape boxes, as part of the project, the source tapes... And all the tapes are stored in the Mars Sound Archives. They retain the intellectual property rights, but we physically hold the item. And we have, about 5 years ago, the library, and you'll see it tonight, built a robot. And there is actually a four-story robot attached to our building that the collections are housed in, and it's temperature and humidity controlled. It's a place for our stuff. It's where we keep our archival collections. So the tapes are there, so if I need to retrieve one of them, we can. That's not a problem at all.
Well, there was time constraints as well for the grant. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have another question, same on the metadata. Did you consider or did you record the treatments, the preservation condition and the preservation treatments, you said 80% of the tapes needed some sort of treatment, so that if you know, a new technology comes along later that cleans a DAT tape or allows you to do that transfer better, you could address those tapes?
It was notated if there was something other than the reel that was used. So if it was either a cassette or the DAT, that was notated. But that's...
Yeah, I think Eric is asking about whether you baked the tape or...
Oh, yeah, yeah. All the sticky shed stuff was baked in a food dehydrator, yeah.
And absolutely. You kept record of that?
No, we didn't.
Whether it was baked, okay.
No, we did not.
The interesting part of that whole process of he would always go to the reel first, and obviously anything that we had already digitized, we did not have them do again. So he would always go to the reel first. In the period of time where we were rolling to things to DAT, we had both a reel and a DAT backup. So if the reel didn't, if for instance, some of those older things had splices in them, all of those older tapes, he would have had to go default to a cassette because that was even before DATs. Yeah, it would just, he would go from reel, if there was a DAT, go to DAT. If there wasn't that, he'd go to the cassette so that we would at least have the, you know, what was on the tape.
You talked about now dealing with born digital files and the different file types generated by, say, Sadie or Pro Tools. Are you preserving those project files or I was curious if you maybe like export like in Edit Decision List or XML or something from those programs and preserve that to kind of show how the files were created.
For the radio show, yes, we are. We've saved all of our Pro Tools files over the years since we've been using it, and that's another thing that we've had to address and go back to some of those old shows and bring them up, because every time there's a new release of Pro Tools. We're about to go through that again with Pro Tools 11. We're jumping from 8 to 11, but anyway. And so we'll have to reopen those and establish them as a new Pro Tools file. But yeah, we do that because of the fact that it is a radio show that's ongoing. A lot of these authors, when they die or when they turn around and win the Pulitzer Prize or just any kind of reason that we need to go back to those tapes, and we have the Pro Tools files available so that we can go back to that.
I was just also in addition to your question, I was just going to say that since we work with commercial recording labels where, you know, 95% of the stuff we get is born digital and 90% of that are Pro Tools session files, it's a part of the Grammy deliverables, best practices for deliverables requirements that I wrote, and also in some other documents. I think that it's very important that those that do use, irrespective of whether it's Pro Tools or not, that what you try to do is you decouple, you separate and create broadcast wave files that are removed from the software, hardware, and firmware and versioning of the particular application that was used to create it.
You know, when we first started out, when digital was first introduced at the radio station, we had DAT tapes. And we all remember what problems DAT tapes were, because if you recorded on one machine, it wouldn't necessarily play on the other because they weren't continuously encoded. And I think that what's happened, and that kind of mashup or inconsistency of technology goes all the way back to the earliest recorded sound. But what we try and do is store, we always say common practice sometimes becomes best practice. And now if you want a file of a photographs, you get a TIFF. Thank God for WAV files is all I got to say, because you can, you know, they're interchangeable. When we started out, we used to have a Sadie system, with Cedar outboxes. The Sadie system was a pain in the butt because it was a proprietary software, and that's what you have to avoid.
You want to save it as a universal file. But when we first started out also, we wanted to go with Pro Tools. But because the library would not allow anybody to use Macs, we couldn't use Pro Tools at that time. We were forbidden from using. There's not a Mac in the library this day.
To this day. We had that problem. The whole university was kind of anti-Mac. I don't know why, but finally, because I work in the communication studies department, and we have film studies there, and so the film people were insisting we've got to have Macs, and then the art department insisted we had to have Macs. So we were the first to make inroads to having Macs, and that's when we went with Pro Tools. But it is weird, but they're not anti-Mac now.
Well, you know, that's a nice thing, though, with the WAV files. She uses a Mac, we use PCs, and we can still exchange the files, and there's nothing lost there.
But what John was saying is that we do, even though we have all these Pro Tools files, we do create a WAV file that is, you know, we keep it outside of the Pro Tools file, so we do have those two things existent. The Pro Tools just makes it easy for us to go back in and gather material and strip out music if we need to and do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, one question over there.
Can you tell us more about the deal with LSO and what they have told you they define as preservation?
With the LSO, how they define it?
Do they mean forever?
They mean forever, yes.
They better not.
Yeah, forever. You know, the LSO, I mean, it is the repository. Well, Rob, you know this. Used to be head of special collections there.
I didn't deal with LSO.
Kurt Cobb came to us, and they keep all the digital files alive forever, and they back them up, too. So, and if we had to move them back into our environment, we could.
And you have a good sense of certainty that you can trust what they're up to, what they're doing for you?
Well, I don't, but Scott certainly does. And I think Stuart Hines on top of that. Because, see, it's not just our audio files. It's terabytes of photos, maps, all those files. Same thing, yeah. I have people higher than me that works with that.
I have to say, when I first came here, that a lot of our old tapes they were put in caves for storage, literally caves, because we have all these caves around Kansas City. So I think I trust this even more than having things in caves. So.
And we also have the original copy, so if we have to go back in and rebake it and transfer it, we can.
We should insert there that beware of anyone who promises preservation forever.
I know. I'm sure they're going to stick us with some price down the road. I can't even believe that they came looking for. They must have needed something to justify the new.
That's very rare.
That's the deal. They needed something to justify their existence, and I mean it makes them an integral part of the university because. You know, it's the old thing that Stuart says, you know, okay, everybody's taking pictures with their cell phones. How long do you think those pictures are going to be around? They're not. You know, if you don't print it, you won't have it in the future. Preserving digital media is the greatest challenge we face, not just in audio, but in archives, you know. It's a big challenge.
You bring a very good point, though, which is the vetting. How do you vet your partner, your collaborator, your vendor, and there's always at one point, I think you have to trust. It's a bit like, I don't know if you remember what was the movie with Jodie Foster? Was it Cosmos maybe?
Contact,
thank you. Where eventually there's this big thing where there's the religious guy and the scientist person, and at one point, they both have faith, just in different things. One is in science and one is religion. So at one point you have to be like, okay, this vendor, this collaborator has been vetted by enough people that I trust it. So you either have to trust your own judgment. Well, eventually you always have to, but.
And there was this Reagan guy that said, trust but verify.
Yeah.
Trust but verify.
But even verification is a matter of trust eventually, right? If you trust the tools they use to verify it, so you can take this forever.
It is interesting. One of the things in developing our website, one of the glitches that we ran into is that some of the things that we want to do on our website, our server was going to be hosted by UMKC, our university, and they were like, oh, yeah, that'll be fine, that'll be fine. And then when it came down to the nuts and bolts of it, we had to go outside. So now we're trusting that we're going to be safe on this outside thing. So I don't know.
It's called belt and suspenders. That's what I always call it.
Yes, Josh.
Yeah, I think that, and Mark, what Mark was also was alluding to a little bit earlier, is with these grant-funded projects and the projects that those of us involved in grant writing, is that in the digital realm we're now looking at, you're looking at grant-funded projects that have a very finite funding and a very finite lifespan versus the opposite side of that, which is whatever all of us have been harping upon, which is the need for continuous stewardship of digital preservation and the digital files themselves. Those two things are very different concepts, and I think that you guys are lucky because your systems office, your IT, seems to be involved. But I think those of us, right, it's a good tip to think about in that those of us involved in grant writing need to get the library systems or campus systems on board with what we're doing before we go and apply for $100,000 grant to preserve a collection that does not have an ongoing digital preservation policy attached to it.
I would even add that not only preservation, but access, actually.
Absolutely.
And yes. Of course, and, preservation and without access is nothing.
And I would only add that we've helping numerous folks write grants that you're just simply going to have to reallocate some costs. We do have to look at a refresh cycle to a certain extent, typically around 3 to 5 years. And if you're not building that in to your grant proposal, I'm not saying that the output of the work is doomed, but you have just raised the percentage of that by a very significant amount by not having access to funds downstream.
Yeah. Also, you know, I've had the privilege of sitting in on an NEH panel, and George will tell you the same thing. For one of the first things they look at is, how is this going to be live in the future? You know, how is it going to be, how are you going to access it, and how is it going to be kept alive? What is their ongoing preservation program? Because they don't want to fund something that's going to go away, and nothing goes away quicker than digital files. We know that. When you've got a problem with them, nothing goes away. I was reminded of that when I was trying to access my PowerPoint last night for my birds thing. Who's that bald guy in the back? Oh, it's Seth.
Look who's talking. I got a little more than you do, Bubala.
Takes one to know one.
Absolutely. In fact, I just wanted to update something for you, Chuck. Sadie has gone through a number of different generations of software, and now everything is completely compatible in the sense that you can open it up within subfolders under Windows and pull a file out any which way you want, broadcast WAV files. However, I'm doing a project for the New York Philharmonic, and their metadata needs to be updated. So what I had to do was install a package of SoundForge on the system and import the files in order to put the metadata in, and then send those files with the proper embedded metadata over to the Philharmonic. So sometimes you have to do these kind of patches if you want to stick with certain systems. But let's not badmouth Sadie. It got us going at the beginning. It was one of the most reliable and still is reliable in the sense of digital integrity and its ability to do all sorts of different methods of editing and releveling and everything is second to none in the sense of how fast and efficient it does it. And it's still one of the leading systems in the world. EMI has used it for decades.
I apologize that if I was bad-mouthing Sadie, I didn't mean to.
Well, we're going back to 1999 when
Seth put in the original system back in 92, actually. So
that was the beginnings of it.
Yeah, and you know, this issue of LTO tapes. Anybody wants to buy some LTO tapes? We got quite a few of them.
I got some AITs if anybody wants at $50 a pop.
Okay, we have time for one more question. We're technically out of time.
Just one thought about Pro Tools projects. Don't use those as your primary source. Anybody who knows about Pro Tools and its compatibility issues, and I would defer to John Spencer, who's an expert, and Chris Lesenik, who is also on this panel. If we're going to talk about content data and maybe whatever other metadata you have in there, I don't know if you've got administrative or technical or provenance data you're saving in there, but back it up. And you know, Will's question over to my right here about XML out, much better choice. Put it in a database and store it somewhere other than Pro Tools projects.
Thank you. That's a good point. Again, I'm going to remind you that we are planning on putting a resource page on the ARSC webpage. So this is put together by the technical committee. So if you go to the technical committee page, you can contact Mark Hood or myself, and we'd love to know what kind of resources you would like listed on the resource page.
If anybody wants one of these cards, please come up to get them. And come to Mars Sound Archives tonight, because it will be fun. Well, there's barbecue and beer.
It's two of the facilities, and we'll have barbecue and a little Boulevard beer.
Oh, Boulevard beer.
We're
it's our
party
local
in the
beer.
Library tonight. Shuttle start leaving at 5:30.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to our panelists.